comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. I am delighted you are here. And I'm delighted to be here. I'm here because you have a right to know. I'm here because you matter. You've no doubt heard, read, maybe discussed, the Illuminati. It's all over the internet. It's been all over television and documentaries. It's not something that we are completely devoid of knowledge about. However, a lot of what you have heard, a lot of what you've heard has probably been right on target, and some of what you have heard has probably been way off target. Even about the Illuminati, there are myths. And some of the things that you have heard that are correct are disturbing enough. Some of the myths are absolutely frightening. And some of the reality is frightening. Well, tonight we're going to talk with someone who knows. And he knows because he used to work for them and was involved in the development of their UFO technology. So it should prove to be this evening, ladies and gentlemen, more than interesting. We're all going to learn things tonight we didn't know, and that's a good thing. Here at the Kevin Smith Show, we publish a weekly newsletter. Is called the K-Files. For those of you who are brand new and you don't know about that, well, now you know. It's free. And all you have to do is get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Look for where it says K-Files, click it, and subscribe. Then you won't have to sit in the dark. And it's free. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to, although most people stay with us forever. I will admit it's an acquired taste if you like things sugar-coated and with icing and chocolate chips on it. Wrong publication. Okay, this one's coming to you straight. But it's free and full of good information, so be sure you subscribe. Also, while you're over at the website, be sure you click where it says Alternative Universe Eye Conference. Now, the Alternative Universe Eye Conference is coming up on April 21st. And what's going to happen is the conference is coming to you. Instead of you having to buy a plane ticket and travel and then rent a hotel and pay for extra meals and ground transportation, it's coming to you. And, you know, almost all conferences you go to, you're going to spend a couple of $100 on tickets in addition to all of that travel expense. Well, how about you sit at home and enjoy from the comfort of your own home this conference with really great presentations and question and answer right after each speaker, well-known speakers, for $10. You can't beat it. Click that link. It's about 4 feet high. If you miss that, you probably won't be able to see the conference either. We'll be back right after this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and what promises to be, I think, an outstanding, excellent conversation this evening with Stan Deo. I think most of you are probably very, very familiar with Stan Deo, and I think that you probably have watched videos on YouTube, or perhaps you have purchased DVDs, and you've seen Stan Deo talking about having at one time worked for the Illuminati. I think you have seen him talking about anti-gravity technology and a lot of other stuff. Quite an interesting individual. And we're delighted to have him with us this evening. You know, he's been with us before, but it's been quite a while. And I don't think that we've ever actually talked about all of this stuff that we're going to talk about tonight. Stan Deo, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted you are back with us.
Glad to be here. Are you able to hear me and see me over there?
Yeah, we can see you and we can hear you, and it's a little bit broken up. We've been having a little bit of trouble with your signal blinking out, the video signal. But if that happens, we'll just click a button here and we'll look at a picture of your smiling face until the video returns.
I was trying to set up some screen share here, and so that you could see the images I'm talking about, some of them anyway. Are you sending a video picture to me?
No.
Ah, all right.
No, my video is going directly out on the broadcast, and we're just picking yours up and putting it with it.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Now, Stan, a lot of people are familiar with you. It would be impossible for there not to be a lot of people familiar with you. But we do have people that are brand new to the genre, or it's just a part of our genre that they haven't really looked into much in the past, and so they've missed the information. Give us a little thumbnail of your background and working for the Illuminati, how that came about, and why you left, and so forth.
Well, I used to live and work in Dallas, being a Texas boy, and back in 1971, I was approached by Dr. James R. Maxfield of Dallas at my place of residence. He sent a man to talk to me. And they had heard me talking to some of my employees and fellow co-workers there about research I've been doing at home in a new method of propulsion and a way to get electricity out of the atmosphere. He sent his man to talk to me and tell me to come see him, and I delayed a month, and eventually I got another visit from his friend. They said, look, you better go this afternoon at 3 o'clock. We've set up an appointment. He wants to talk to you. So I get over to this guy's office, to Dr. Maxfield's office there in Dallas, and he takes me into his office and starts showing me photographs of the wall of an under the South Pole trip he'd taken a submarine with Dr. Edward Teller, and, you know, that he was part of Teller's research group, and that his specialty was radiation research. And, you know, I was fairly impressed with his credentials. He mathematics and all kinds of stuff, and a medical doctor to boot. When we had been sitting there in his office, a small office, for a while, he shut the door, and he said, now, boy, he says, tell me what you've been doing at home in your lab. And I thought, well, here I am talking to this guy who rubbed shoulders with a nuclear physicist of great renown, you know, Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb and stuff, and he wants to know what I've been doing at home. And I didn't even know what to say without sounding like an idiot, you know, because I didn't have degrees, and I'd never finished at the Air Force Academy, so I didn't have even a bachelor's. So I thought, well, sir, I've been working on a formula and some devices to unify gravity and magnetism. And he said, wait, stop. Don't put it, play footsie with me. Tell me exactly what you're doing. He says, is it anti-gravity? I said, I'm surprised you use that kind of a term, but yes. And he said, well, we've been doing that and researching that for a number of years, since the mid-50s, and we've even developed craft using it. And we have about three, maybe four different types of craft, aircraft and spacecraft, that use electrogravitics, which is what anti-gravity is. And, of course, you know, he probably saw my jaw hit the floor because back in 71 talking with anybody about this kind of stuff, much less a guy of his renown and his qualifications, was considered to be very foolish. You look like an idiot. And so I would just sit there with right. Yeah, center of gravity, you've done that. See, yeah, we've had flying saucers. We had plasma craft in the beginning. Now we've gone to the anti-gravity systems, and we'd like you to join our team. I said, okay, what does that entail? He said, well, we'd have to send you down to our Australian branch, and, you know, you'd work down there. I said, well, yeah, I got a family, I got a job here, I've got a mortgage and a house and stuff, and, you know, investments in the market. He said, yeah. He said, look, we'll take care of all that. We'll help you sell your house if you can't do it. We'll give you 30 days to do it. And we'll have to get you to a medical and your family. It's a standard procedure to go into a foreign country like that. And we'll send you down to Melbourne, where you will meet your control person and so forth. So I'm sitting there thinking, well, that sounds pretty easy. Well, write a number on that piece of paper there in front of you about how much money you need to clear all your stuff up here. So I did. And he says, okay. We'll take care of that. And he said, now, just pardon me a second. I'm going to call the Australian consulate in San Francisco. I remember we were in Dallas, so he picks up the phone and calls the secretary and says, get me, Bob Gray over in the Australian consulate in San Francisco. So she rang and buzzed him back and said, okay, the secretary's on the line because Bob's out to lunch right now, so fine. He talks to the secretary and says, look, tell Bob this is Jim Maxfield, and tell him I've want to send another one of Maxfield's boys to Australia, and would he send someone to take care of that? So we hung up the phone, and you know, at this point in the conversation, I was just kind of numb. I thought, dang, what kind of power have these guys got? And I said, well, okay, what do I do next? And he says, well, you go home, we'll contact you, the medical will be next, they'll send a person over to take care of that and to interview you and your family. So I waited, and sure enough, 3 or 4 weeks later, a woman came out from the Australian consulate and booked an appointment and had me go into the doctor with my wife and everything, get x-rays for tuberculosis and all that kind of stuff. Everything checked out, and she said, okay, I've got your details, now meet me at the hotel here. And so my wife and I went up there to meet her in this hotel room, and she brought me in, and she says, okay, well, now we're going to send you down to Australia as, what would you like to be, electrical engineer? I said, well, I don't have a degree in that. I studied physics and electricity and stuff like that. That's why, you know, Dr. Maxwell wanted me to come join the project. She gets her pen out and she says, okay, you're going to be an electrical engineer. We're going to emigrate you to Australia as electrical engineer, and that'll take care of that paperwork. Okay, we'll see you there. The airline tickets will be sent to you when I get back to San Francisco, and we'll have a departure date. And I assume you've sold your house. Yes, I have. And she says, good, then you'll be free to come on down and see us down there. And you'll make a fine new addition to Australia. And, you know, and then excused herself, said, okay, that's it. We'll get back in touch with you. And I left the room with my wife, and I said, can you believe that? You know, They just kind of write on a piece of paper and things happen. I said, you know, this is incredible. And it never dawned on me that this was part of a much bigger organization across the planet. To me, it was just like a black ops or a secret project that the government had running. And, you know, I thought, well, that'll be okay. I can deal with that. I'd love to work on it, especially flying saucers. I mean, who wouldn't? So, got the tickets a bit later. And at the same time, I've been working for the FBI undercover in the place where I was working there in Dallas. And my participation with the FBI, investigating a group, believe it or not, called the Illuminati, my investigation had been compromised. I've been caught on a security camera in the organization I was investigating late at night when I was trying to get some information on some people that came in a helicopter from the White House that day. And anyway, it looked like I might be in a lot of trouble by the Illuminists that I was spying on. So I got a bit frightened, and I had a departure date of about 10 days from that point in time. It was on a weekend, on a Sunday, and so I gathered the family together at the house, my wife, two boys, and I had us all pack what we couldn't get rid of into boxes, and I was going to let my dad or my brother pick them up after we had gone, but I had told no one, as I was instructed by Dr. Maxwell's people, I told no one where we were going and when. So Mom and Dad didn't even know. I left them a note, and I mailed them a letter to say, this is what's happening. You come and see me off at the airport here on Sunday. And they got the letter, and that was only a couple of days, one day, I guess, because they were on the other side of Dallas. And I was busy packing boxes and things like that. Now, once we got all packed and ready to go, supposed to leave a week after that on Sunday, I told the family, okay, let's head to the airport. I called Dad, and I said, meet us there now. And we went to Lovefield Airport there in Dallas, and, Mom and Dad said, why are you going? And I said, look, I can't explain it to you right now, but trust me, it's a worthwhile project. And it's in research, and, I want to do it. And I'll tell you when I can. Mom got all upset and said, tears. And I thought, well, this is because I'm leaving, sudden notice, without any notice, like this suddenly. And I said, what are you crying for? She said, well, you're going down there to Australia with all those head-hunting natives, How are you going to survive? And at that time, knowledge of Australia wasn't quite what it is today. So I kind of laughed and I told her, no, it's okay. There's really a lot of good people down there. And, buildings and houses and things and cities. So I grabbed the family. We went up the plank to the Qantas aircraft and took off. Now, I was a week early. So we flew into Sydney. It was about a 15, 16-hour trip one way there. And got into Sydney probably about 3 or 4 in the morning. And got out of the aircraft and went into the terminal, and it was all dark. There wasn't a soul in there. I mean, it shut down and pulled up the carpets, at mm-hmm. 9 or 10 at night. So I thought, well, we'll just sit here on this bench here and wait till somebody shows up to take us on the next leg of the journey from Sydney down to Melbourne. And a pilot came in, and I could tell from the uniform, he came walking over. He said, oh, hi, folks. He said, you're a bit early. And I said, yeah, we're waiting on our flight. He says, who are you flying with? And he says, look, I'm with the same airline. He says, I looked at my ticket, and he says, look, I've got an earlier flight. I'm flying down to Melbourne. Hitch a ride with me. I said, well, how do I change the tickets? Yeah, I don't worry about it. I'll tell him at the desk. So instead of being on the plane we were supposed to be on, we got on his plane and flew down to Melbourne. Now, understand, I went a week early because I wasn't sure whether I was going to get bombed on the plane or whatever because of the Illuminous connection with the FBI. In fact, the FBI told me, get down there when you get down there to Australia, keep a low profile, and if you hear that J. Edgar Hoover dies or is replaced after you get there, then you're on your own. We can't even help you with our legal office down there. And so I said, okay, and got down there. And as I said, very quiet in Melbourne. We didn't tell anyone, didn't make my contact agent or anything. And I just kept my head real low and called a private person there who had been recommended to me as a personal friend of another guy in Dallas who was in Australia, and that he would take care of me. And this is my doing, not Teller's and Maxwell's doing. So I got there and got settled, got a car, got a house on rented, and then I made contact with my control down there, who was Captain Sir John Williams, well-known in the area and well-known to the Queen of England, who knighted him for gold recovery during World War II. Very tall, stately gentleman, and he was the one that was arranging all my activities there for the research. And again, he was an Illuminist unknown to me. And it started to dawn on me one day when he took me to lunch at what's called the Australian Club there, which was the cigar-smoking, port-drinking guys that ran the country behind the scenes. They told politicians and prime ministers, you'll do this, you'll appear here, you'll say that. And over lunch, I started to realize, listening to them talk, that this is what they did, and people jumped when they snapped. So as time passed, I found that, I wrote a couple of papers on propulsion, which I still have, and they were classified top secret. And I can make the story longer, but suffice it to say that by coincidence, and really it was this, the aeronautical research labs where I was assigned, the officer who was in charge of reviewing scientific papers for this kind of stuff happened to live right across the street from the house that I chose and I rented. And he'd been there for a long time. It's just a coincidence. And he told me the day after I submitted my papers to his boss, to Tom Keeble, he said, what did you write about? He says, I can't ask it. He was asking me this down at the corner, 7-Eleven type mom and pop store, and I was down there getting something for the wife, and he said, you know, he was behind me, and he said, look, what did you write in that paper? They took it away from me today when it came across my desk and said I wasn't cleared, you know, to read your paper. And I said, well, I'll give you a copy. He said, well, don't make it obvious, but if you could sneak it into my mailbox, you know, at night or something so I could have a look, I'd sure appreciate it. So even this guy, they had censored from looking at my stuff. And his boss and this group of young engineers that were there at Aeronautical Research Labs had me in a meeting in Tom's office one day. And in that meeting, they asked me, they said, you know, how did you come to get appointed to come down here? And has anybody from Australian Security and Intelligence, ASIO, contacted you? Have you been in the country? And I said, well, not to my knowledge. And I said, you know, I just did what Dr. Maxwell said. I came down here to work on this. And he said, I said, do you guys, have you got any photographs or videos of the flying saucers that aren't ours or even that are ours in testing down here? And several of them looked at each other, and then they looked at me, and they said, well, no, but maybe we could show you sometime. And we're pointing at the bookshelf like this behind them, and there was a bug, apparently, in the bookshelf. And they wanted to show me stuff that what I wasn't supposed to see, but they said, look, you're being monitored, and so we can't tell you right now. But they were out of shot, so they could point, and nobody saw them. And things progressed from there, and I found out that Captain Sir John did not like Jewish folk too much at all. And I guess they'd made a mistake in checking my credentials because my father was Jewish. I could see from a lot of things they said that I wasn't going to be very popular there.
Listen, we have to step away for a break just a moment. Hold that thought, and we'll pick up right there when we come back from this break. Ladies and gentlemen, Stan Deo, I told you this was going to be interesting. And there's a whole lot more on the way. I recommend, now it's up to you, of course, but I recommend that you get on the telephone during this break and call all your friends, your family, your neighbors, even your enemies, and tell them to tune in. Because I think they're going to hear something tonight that will, well, I don't know, blow at least one sock off, maybe both. And we're going for both. We're going to go for both. All right, we'll be back right after this.
And you are smart because you are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
You are indeed listening to The Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Stan Deo. Stan, when we had to step away for break, you had just told us they hadn't checked your background very well. And then we had to step away for break. So let's just pick up there, and we'll move forward.
All right. Well, the one of the things that put us apart, Sir John and I, was that I complained about the technology that we were using at the time, and not thinking about, for instance, there was the energy converter, which would take electricity straight out of the air. And I wonder why we couldn't give that technology to various Asian countries and African countries whose people needed water and have energy just to survive, just to grow crops and eat them. And they told me that I didn't really understand what it was all about, that in essence, they didn't want certain countries to multiply and, you know, make more babies. They wanted them to die by natural attrition. Now, years later, I did happen to intercept an operative from Thailand who was part of their group after I'd left the organization, and he had in his briefcase documents that he was quite unhappy about, and he was taking them back to Langley to suggest that they withhold grain loans to India at a certain time to cause the natural attrition of 100 million people, to kill them by famine. I wasn't happy about it, he wasn't happy about it, and through a couple of things that we did there, I was able to get the documents out of his briefcase, which was chained onto his wrist, photocopy them, put them back in, and no one was the wiser. Still have the documents now, but that was a long time ago. Sir John and a couple of the other guys that were also knights, knighted by the Queen, got unhappy with me over my wish to tell people about some of the technology we had. Not everything, but some of the things I thought would be useful to save lives. And one morning, they sent a Sir John's driver around with a bunch of my papers and stuff and said, we're disavowing any knowledge of you, now you're cut off. And in essence, I was being fired for being too vocal or whatever. Things got a little bit warm after that, and my wife and children went back to the States. I was kind of, it was suggested to me at a luncheon meeting by one of the guys who was still working with the group, the Illuminist, that perhaps I could finish my research on another project they had at the bottom of a mine shaft about 5,000 feet deep. And then I was to tell no one, and they would put me down there and send supplies down. I could set up a lab down at the bottom of this this mine and do research on the atmospheric energy converter to use it so that you could have an antenna underground instead of above ground. Basically, what they were saying was, tell no one, we're going to put you 5,000 feet down in a hole, and no one will know you're there, and no one will know when you disappear either.
Mm-hmm.
This motivated me to to figure out a way to get away from them and to disappear into the outback, into the bush, which I did do, and I still keep the technique I used quiet because I might have to use it again, you never know. I did escape them for about 6 months, and I was, at the time they caught up with me, one agent, an American agent, caught up with me and the two people I was traveling with at my campfire in the middle of the Nullarbor Desert in southwest Australia. He had my dossier, he knew who I was and all about what I was trained in and what I'd been doing. Apparently his job was to find me because they'd had trouble tracking me and to then, I suppose, dispose of me at that point or to make sure I didn't talk any more publicly about what I knew. But for some reason, unknown to me, he didn't do that. And he said, look, I'm going to pretend I didn't see you. I'm going on over to Perth and do some other business I got over there, and you're free to go. I was happy about that, went on over to Perth, and you know, kept a low profile for a couple of years, working at odd jobs to feed myself. I mean, really, you know, like carton salt bags down at the docks in Fremantle there, south of Perth, and really hard stuff just to eat. And one day, I was taking one of my closets, they're like their wardrobes and their wooden devices, you know, wooden furniture that they make. Down in Australia, it's very common. Instead of having a closet built in, you have this wardrobe that stands mm-hmm. in your room. It's a piece of furniture. And I had too many of them in this house that I was renting. They were left there. And so I was going to throw this one that was nice, but it was in the way. I was going to throw it on the garbage dump. Took it in the back of the station wagon, went on out there and midday, and I had the thing laid out long ways in the back of the station wagon and drove into the garbage dump and paid my $5 or whatever it was and backed over to the edge, and I was going to get it out as soon as it was my turn to dump and throw it over the edge into the valley of refuse. Well, there was a couple of cars behind me, and the one right behind me, a guy got out, and he came over and said, are you throwing that away? And I said, yeah, look, I know it's a nice piece, but I don't need it. I don't know where to put it, so I'm going to toss it. And he said, oh, I need one of those. He said, could I get you to drive over to my house, and I'll take it for you. And I said, hey, sure, no problem. Well, one of the garbage dump guys who was standing right next to it says, no, you can't do that, sir. He's here on the garbage dump. It now has to go in the garbage. And the reason this guy, I found out later, this garbage guy was saying that, was because they have mining rights to the garbage dump. They gave them rights legally to mm-hmm. mine whatever gets thrown there. And they could see a buck in this, you know, this nice wardrobe. So I said, well, look, I haven't really taken it out of the car yet, and so it's not in the dump. And the guy that wanted it said, yeah, that's true. He hasn't set foot out with it. And so, you know, I'm going to take it. Well, the garbage guy then turned around and whistled at a couple of his other mates, and one of them had a D9 Caterpillar dozer that they were shoving stuff over with. lowered the blade and came over and sat right next to this guy's car behind me and said, if you don't let us have that, we're going to push your car over the edge. Well, with that, the guy that was wanting the wardrobe reaches in his pocket and pulls out his police badge, and he says, I'm taking it. You got any complaints? And they said, no, that's fine. So I followed the guy home, and by this time we collected a whole crowd of people throwing stuff in the tip, watching all this happen. And so they followed us like a caravan of people out over to this guy, to the policeman's house. And he invited everybody in and made coffee and tea for people, and we sat around and talked about it all, had a good laugh, and asked what I was doing and what I had done. I told him a little bit, but not a lot, about working on, you know, round discs that, flew like flying saucers, because I didn't really want to draw a lot of attention to myself. Well, one of the guys that was at the dump, and had come over to have tea, a stranger to the cop, a stranger to me, was named Hugh Kitson, and he was a TV producer, film guy from England, who was assigned to the local TV channel, Channel 9. He heard the discussion, and that was it, and everybody went home. Well, a couple days later, I was out in the front of my rented house, watering the lawn, doing just normal things, and this Hugh Kitson guy that was at the cop's house drives up and says, oh, hi, remember me? I said, yeah. He said, look, I want a project for the network here. We're filming a UFO documentary, and it's really going to be a nice one, and we'd like for you to come in and talk to us on camera and put your testimony in to the show. And I said, well, okay, within certain limits, certain things I can say, I'll do that, yeah. So I went into Channel 9 at the appointed time and met Guy Baskin, who was the director of the whole thing, and also from England. They told me what they had done so far, what they'd filmed. They showed me a bunch of the raw footage, so I knew who they'd interviewed. They interviewed Steven Spielberg and Dr. Alan Hynek and all the who's who of the UFO thing, plus the RAAF officers, and they had filmed from amateurs of flying lights and things in various places, and the normal type UFO thing. They heard what I had to talk about and looked at each other and said, right, what we're going to do, it's going to be an hour production. We're going to make it an hour and a half. You get the last half hour, and we're going to put you on camera. We'll film it. You can help us edit it, and that's what we'll do with you. And so I did. That show went to air, and it was the highest rating documentary show that the network had ever had. It was so good that they funded two more shows, live audiences with me, and flying me up in the north to make it there, and up in the mining country to talk to people that had seen, you know, flying saucers up there and all that kind of stuff. A publishing house over on the other side of the country in Melbourne saw the show and offered to send me a ghostwriter to write the story, because I, quite honestly, I don't like to write, and English wasn't my favorite subject. It's a painful thing, but I agreed, and I signed a contract with them, and they messed around for 6 months and burned out three writers who said it was too hard on this Illuminati business that I was talking about. So I flew over, on my attorney's advice there in Perth, I flew over to Melbourne, and I took my contract back and showed them how they'd breached the contract, and they had no legal right to anything that I was going to say or write, and I decided I would write the book myself, and that way there wouldn't be anybody going on strike about it being too hard. So I wrote it, and that book was, I self-published it in 1978, a year after all this drama had started at that garbage tip. And the book was called, and still is called, The Cosmic Conspiracy. And it deals heavily with the Illuminati, this mysterious group of powerful men in the United States, Russia, England, Canada, Australia, Norway, all over the planet, who together had formed a consortium of engineers, scientists, physicists to develop a secret technology to use for a special project that we can discuss in a minute that was a global project. The book was an instant success. I sold out the first edition of 5,000 copies I had to borrow money to print in 10 days. And then I went on to print more and more, and I got the help of the local churches all across Australia. They were very keen on it because what I was explaining to them from my viewpoint was fulfilling a lot of what the new biblical prophecy was talking about and what was coming to the whole planet. The churches and I moved tens of thousands of the book, and it became the in the top 10 bestsellers for 3 years in Australia. All self-published, all self-distributed, and ended up going to 22 some odd countries. And now then, over a quarter of a million copies later, people all over the planet have read it and used it for research, and there was no advertising. It was just word of mouth. And they're still selling. I made the final edition, adding things to it that I think are important for the next 2 years. I made that in 2010. Now, I don't think I'll put any more changes or additions to the book. The first 200 pages are just like I wrote it in 1977, 78. But I've added another 100 pages of things after that, documents, appendices, commentaries on some new translation of the Book of Daniel and how that affects what's about to happen here worldwide.
Where can people get that book?
On our website at standeo.com. If you go to standeo.com, that's the website that my wife maintains, and she's a webmaster for it. And you scroll down about a page or so, and you'll see pictures of all the books and DVDs and CD-ROMs that either she has written or I've written or our friends have written, and that we publish and sell on our website, or the shopping cart, which is over in San Antonio. There are a couple of good books there, really good books that are written for this time. Now, Holly and I teamed up. I got a new wife many, many years ago, and she is a really good addition to my life, I got to tell you, for a number of reasons. But one of them is that she is an English major, agreed. And she likes to write. And she had been collecting data on how people can get prepared for various disasters, emergencies, whether it be financial, whether it be weather, warfare, nuclear warfare. She was doing that before we even met. She collected all this stuff over the years we were together and started making a book out of it. And getting also questions from people that would go to the website she was maintaining, and they would write in and say, look, have you ever thought about covering such and such a topic, or what do you know about it? And so she added this to the book, and it's now 632 pages of 8.5 by 11 paper, and it's not padded. It is hard meat on everything, and it's about 69 chapters, I think, on each one dealing with a different type of preparation.
We have to step away from break. The music's taking over. We'll pick up right there when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, more with Stan Deo in just a moment. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Stan Deo. Stan, we stepped away just as you were telling us about this book that I think you said Holly wrote.
Right, Dare to Prepare. And her book is basically how to prepare for a number of disasters, but certainly for the approach of the confusion and chaos across the planet that is going to bring about the one world government. People will actually support it and call for it, but we're going to see some very trying times in the weather and in the arena of the warfare, nuclear warfare. And her book just tells people how to economically prepare their families and their businesses for such events. Cosmic Conspiracy book is on the cover up, the technology, things I've been involved in, and documentation which people can check out, which is the instrumentation that the Illuminists are going to use to bring about this new world order, and how they're creating certain events and catastrophes that are leading people to want that new world order.
So what makes these together? What makes these guys and gals? I guess there's women involved too. The Illuminists. What is it that makes them think they have the right to control the world?
Well, I suppose in some cases it might just be that they've deluded themselves into thinking someone's got to do something, or we're going to kill ourselves. Our technology is rapidly approaching the point where we're going to destroy the planet and hence ourselves, and no one will live. In other cases, it might be that they just are on an ego trip and they feel that they're better than everybody else. They're more educated. They know more about how people behave. And we don't have to be too educated, any of us, to see that people behave badly, whether it be in a riot from a fire or whether it be a hurricane's approaching and they clean the shelves off of the supermarket in 2 days. We know that people become very egocentric and very concerned with their own personal safety over everyone else when disasters or large threats face them. The information I got from the cotton top, cigar smoking, port drinking illuminists that I worked with, or four, is that Hitler and his ilk had tried to, like Napoleon wanted to do, had tried to force people into a large government. In Hitler's case, he wanted to go for the world. And he wanted to control people so that he could control crime and make things go the way he wanted. And he could get rid of people he considered inferior physically or mentally, like Jews or blacks and certain types of Christians. He wanted to get rid of them because they were a problem to stable order under dictatorship. Well, now, the Illuminists knew that Hitler and his type would not work because the French taught them that the resistance movement could tear down any nice organized dictatorship by blowing up bridges, food chains, you know, all this kind of stuff. And they knew that it wouldn't be stable long enough to make a happy one world government. The Illuminists also had found by experience setting up the League of Nations and eventually the United Nations that by negotiation they could not overcome the differences of religion, of family politics, of economic disparity, of like the dollar value in the versus the rupee or something like that. There were a number of issues that they couldn't get every one of the 196 nations at that time to agree on to make a one world government of their own free will. So if they couldn't force them in a dictatorship, and if they couldn't kind of convince them in a negotiated arena like the United Nations, what option was left? Well, that's what has become known as the third alternative, or alternative three.
Now, let me say, I have, as you've been talking, I'm doing what I do every night, and that is I'm jotting down notes for things to refer back to, and alternative three is one of the notes I just jotted down in the past few minutes. As you were describing how they arranged for you to go to Australia, and you weren't supposed to tell anybody, and you just get there, and nobody knows what you're working on. And you know, in the television show Alternative 3, that is the scenario that happened with a lot of the scientists that disappeared.
Well, that's true. The way they presented Alternative 3, though, was not exactly everything, but it because I think that movie was set there to explain to actually mine, to gather like minds in the community who could see what was happening, what the Illuminists were doing, so they would help without knowing the final play in the real Alternative 3. I do remember the book, and they used a fictitious name like Grodin or something like that for the astronaut that was in the book. But yes, it is very, very close to the truth. The third alternative was this. Let us develop technology behind the scenes, underground, wherever, and not release it for decades. Let us develop a whole new subculture that we tell no one about. And we'll develop our flying saucers, we'll develop our anti-gravity, our molecular physics to open doorways in solid walls and that kind of stuff, and to pass through walls without doors, you know, objects passing through each other like that. Let us develop all these technologies and create an alien race, or what appears to be an alien race, to fly in when we've engineered through the media mainly major crisis curves, so that everyone that's just a plebe out there in the world, just a normal person, is going to be frightened for his job, for food, for his safety, his family safety, from one or all of these crisis curves that we will make more intense, more threatening than they really are at that point, so that we can get everybody ready to cut their wrists, and then we'll fly in over the horizon out from outer space, our alien messiahs, in essence. They will come with technology. They won't eat us. They will come and help us to build a one-world government that is of no religion, of no political background, you know, is not interested in taking from us, and it will appear to be, you know, totally benevolent, and people will run to this new offer of coming from the skies because there's no track record. It doesn't belong to Russia, United States, Great Britain, anybody, China, nothing. And that alternative is the best thing they had to offer. And it runs basically true to human psychology. I've often lectured on this this concept, and I use this example. Two brothers still at home with, and they're teenagers, let's say, young teenagers with their family at home. They share a room, and at night, quite frequently, they will throw pillows at each other and mess around and make noise, and the dad will yell from his bedroom down the hallway, "Stop! I want some sleep. Be quiet, or I'm going to come in there and I'm going to ring the bell." And they keep doing it. And they're fighting against each other. And, "No, you took my thing. No, I've got it." And yelling back and forth. So the dad comes down the hallway with this 8-foot-long, wide, meat-cleaving belt. And he hits the door with the hand like this, smack. And the door falls down. Kaboom! And he says, "If you don't stop, I'm going to kill you." Now, suddenly, the two brothers who've been fighting are best mates. And they say, "Yes, Dad." "Mm-hmm." And go to sleep. And they're peaceful. Now, this is the concept of the alien brothers, or alien father, in essence, coming with his troops to settle the nations who are all brothers of man, who are fighting over various resources, over various religions, and all this kind of stuff. And they're making noise, in essence. In fact, some of the ancient records that have been dug up in clay tablets over in the Middle East have talked about, like, the Anunnaki saying that mankind makes a lot of noise, and it's very similar to the example I give with the brothers and their father. But offering a solution from a group that has the obvious power to travel across the stars has obviously overcome their differences, because there are different types of these alien beings, and they're probably just bioengineered robots and variants of humans with gene structure modifications that have been done underground so nobody knows about it. But these different types, different looking humanoids, all get along together and they don't fight. So mankind would readily say, "Well, look, they're offering to help us or to annihilate us or to step back and let us annihilate ourselves." And certainly their offer seems a lot better than nuclear war, germ warfare, EMP pulses that wipe out civilization, nuclear war, you know, geophysical disasters, earthquakes, they can take care of all of that. So people will run like sheep to that gate being opened by the Illuminati saying, "We want that." Now, this was kind of the overall plan of the Illuminists, and that's how they arrived at Alternative 3. The problem is that...
Tell you what, we have to step away for break. So
okay. All right.
That's a good place for us to step away for break. The problem is, and ladies and gentlemen, just hang on the edge of your seat and we'll find out what the problem is when we come back from this break. We're talking this evening with Stan Deo. Remember, you can access his books and DVDs and CDs at standeo.com. We will be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and for those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour. We're talking this evening with Stan Deo, and man, have you missed, oh, I would say several universes of information. But we're glad you're here now.
Better to go away with your cup half full than to have missed it all and go away empty, huh? Stan Deo, as we went away for break, you had been talking about the plans for the that the Illuminati, or the Illuminus, as you refer to them, have. This Alternative 3, the real Alternative 3 plan. And you said that there's a problem with it, and then we had to take a break. The problem is what?
Well, back in the early 50s, late 40s, when the Roswell incident took place, our Illuminists, to their own surprise, became aware of beings that were not of their making. They didn't even have the genetic technology to do it at that time. The little grays, the tall grays that are talked about quite frequently in the UFO circles, were present and presented themselves to the Illuminists, to the upper echelon of it. So instead of having to create an alien invasion as a false flag, the Illuminists were faced with a real alien invasion, but it wasn't an invasion, it was just a small presence at that time. The threat from them was huge because they obviously had anti-gravity technology at that time, the alleged aliens. So the Illuminists said, look, it would disassociate, it would make the population very unstable just after World War II has ended if we told them that you guys were here and that you had super technology. And, you know, there were movies that were being made in the early 50s about how they were, the alleged aliens, if they were out there, were, you know, man-eating terrible things and possess your body, your mind, your soul, that kind of stuff. So the Illuminists were saying to real aliens, look, let's make a deal. You give us some technology, we'll help you to, you know, do your research here, whatever it is you do, and come to find out that they were here on this long trip, allegedly, and that they needed to set up a base or two here, and they wanted to study our genetic pool here of animals and people, and that occasionally they might need some human subjects and animal subjects to do their genetic research, and that they would leave us alone, that they would share technology and stay in the background so that people couldn't know that they were really present. Well, this worked fine for the Illuminists. They figured, well, okay, we'll go underground, we'll develop technology that will let us protect ourselves from these people, because if they're like us, they want to take over and do it their way, and as soon as they figure out everything operates on the Earth, they'll take us over. So the Illuminists played ball, made agreements, contracts, treaties, and offered underground bases to these beings that were shared jointly by the humans and the aliens. And this is leaked out into the press with various whistleblowers that have tried to tell part of it, and of course some of them were rapidly taken out of the game. They died. And the bases were in tunnels. I mean, they started out maybe only 20, 25, 30 feet in diameter. And these tunnel boring machines, which the Germans and the Japanese have really led production on and development of, can now generate tunnels that are like 42 feet in diameter, or 2 30s together, you know, like that. And they're all over the world. There's some crisscrossing America, Arizona, Colorado. I don't know how far they go. I've never been down in, but my uncles, actually, who wired atomic bomb tests for the government, have been in some of the tunnels out in Nevada. So all this stuff was done underground, and also at the base. The base is at the South Pole under the ice cap. The only way that you could really spy on what we were doing, what they were doing, the aliens and the humans in these bases, was to get in a submarine and go down there under the pole and find the spot where you've entered, to go under the ice cap onto the land, under the ice, where the bases are. Area 51, Dulce, all these are basically either underground or above ground, and where people could sneak in and take photos from the air or whatever. And I wouldn't put my secret projects like the alien presence or anti-gravity on these areas where someone could accidentally stumble onto it, get a photo, and release it on the internet. So if you stop and think about it, the best place is under the sea, under the ice cap, where the average human being just cannot go and spy. That keeps the things a secret. there's a lot more to where those bases are, where they have been, that will probably be basis for another show when we talk about the inside of the Earth. But believe me, they were there and are there. Now, I was out of the organization by the time that the aliens, we'll call them for the moment, they're not really that alien, that the aliens kicked the humans out of the bases. And what had happened was in the late 70s, when I was told this, the alleged aliens had built enough infrastructure using human resources. They built enough infrastructure and industry underground, underwater, wherever they were, to get rid of the humans that were there and say, look, we don't need you anymore. We're really here developing weapons for war, and we're having a war with where we came from. And this is where the ancient Sumerian texts and the Bible and all this stuff talking about fallen ones from the upper levels comes into play. The tales tell of the Elohim, the creators of Earth and all that is, living in a concentric universe at a very high energy level compared to us. And there's another level after that, and another level after that, and perhaps even as many as 7 levels of coexisting concentric or parallel universes, which pass through each other without touching. And again, this is something Einstein postulated close to the time of his death, but the ancient records talk about beings being cast out of the upper levels by the Elohim because there was a rebellion. Where the leader of that was Lucifer, or Satan, I think it was probably the modern name for him, wanted to take over the throne and depose the Elohim and run the heavens up there the way he wanted. Now, as I understand it, there's no way they can do this because the Elohim control time itself and can manipulate back, forward, in between, everywhere in time. And therefore, someone's going to play a trick on them. They already know it because they peeked ahead and they can come back and alter things so you can't win. And that's okay with me because what they've set up is a society, as far as I can determine from the old writings, a society that is free as long as you let your mind, your thoughts tie into a central source which monitors your intent so that you can't accidentally, squash an ant or ruin the harmony of the environment where you are when you're in their level. But that's not what Lucifer wanted to do. Anyway, without getting too religious about it, these alleged aliens were Lucifer's troops and himself that were relegated to Earth with only minimal technology to get them through the gateway from the parallel universe to our universe. And again, this is recorded in the tale of the Tower of Babel, where Nimrod wanted to build a tall tower to reach up to the heavens to become as one of them. And it says in there, the heavenly beings said, we're going to knock the Tower of Babel down because we don't want them to get up here and become as one of us. They're not ready for this. Now, Babel is Babel, B-A-B-E-L, in the Middle East. And in the Middle East, Babel, or Babel, is the gateway to God. Mm-hmm. L-O-E-L, Babel. And the Baalbek Plateau there, where they built these things, there was probably up at the top of this kind of stepped pyramid, there was up the top a gateway. It had to be up above the ground and insulated for the electric charges that occur when you gate from the parallel universes to ours. I found an actual blueprint cut in a clay tablet and fired up, fired and hardened, in the time of Marduk the Great. And it was two-thirds of it survived World War II. The Nazis had it, and one-third of it was destroyed. But two-thirds survived, and enough that I could use Photoshop and bring out the floor plan for the front view of this tower of Babel, and also a plan view, a top view, of the actual layout of the top area where the gods appeared to man and then descended down the steps after a period of hours to be with man. So these beings who have taken over these bases that we helped them build are from that crowd. And they're having a war that's coming to a head very shortly, like in a decade or so, between them and the Elohim who were in the upper levels. I know this sounds pretty strange, but I'm telling it like it is. And I'm convinced myself, having studied this and been in the organization, and although I've never, to my knowledge, met a creator being, a watcher, an alien, if you want to call it that, I know they're there. And I've been retranslating part of the book of Daniel, which was written about 650 B.C., plus or minus a few years. And in there was a coded message given to Daniel. And Daniel, by the way, in Hebrew, Daniel is judge of God, like God's judge. And he was given secrets that were encoded into his book in three languages, but possibly four, count some of the Sumerian words that were in there, that would be sealed or hidden from translation until the last days. And it even says that. I have followed along others who have been retranslating them, and I picked eight verses in there, which I've painstakingly put into the final edition of The Cosmic Conspiracy 2010. And those eight verses, it took me 3 months to retranslate them because of all the research I had to do to figure out what the words meant, because they weren't all pure Hebrew. Some Chaldean, Aramaic, similar to Hebrew-type language. And the result of it was something that was startling. And that's why I put in the book about how it talks about the fallen one, the leader of them, coming to Earth with his minions, and he's going to appoint or support a human being to head up a world government, a dictatorial government. He's going to give that person high technology, power, but he'll be the hand in the glove moving that guy's lips when he's telling people how it's going to be done across the planet. For doing this, this new world leader, the human leader, will give, according to Daniel, will give certain of the 10 regions the planet's divided into totally over to the control of the aliens to do with the people and nations, you know, the land and everything underneath that, the region, as they please. Now, the Daniel translation I've done also shows that the Lucifer or fallen one treats himself as a god, little g god, not the god. And there's a coded message in three words, Al Kal El, in Daniel. And it's saying, you know, it's like he's put himself above the god of gods and above the desire of women, or, you know, the desire of women is what it says, and above all other gods. Now, in English, Hebrew, most languages, when you are comparing things in a string, you know, and, or whatever, you do things of, like, apples to apples to apples, and not apples and rocks and cheese. So if he said this new leader is going to be supported by a fallen one coming from the upper levels who considers himself above the god of gods and the desire of women, does that mean he's queer? No. That's what a lot of people tried to say because they didn't understand. But when you read that in the viewpoint of Daniel, who was a very, very devout Jewish boy, Hebrew, born that way and then taken into captivity by the Babylonians, when you read that in light of his upbringing, the desire of Hebrew women, his women in his culture, the desire of women was to be the mother of the Son of God, the Messiah, that would come to earth to set things straight. So it says, when you view it in that perspective, that the Antichrist's backer, the fallen one who considered himself to be above the God of gods, is also considering himself to be above the Son of God, which is a man, God of gods hybrid, and all other gods. So you see, those three things are equal. And in Hebrew, when they write those three words, Al Kal El, they use a lamed, which is an L, which is made with a snake-looking tail. Mm-hmm. And the snake, or the lamed, is the tallest letter right in the middle of the Hebrew alphabet. And mm-hmm. It gives a snake, like the Garden of Eden, the Tree of Knowledge. The snake was responsible. And there's three snakes starting each of those three words in that passage, that verse. There are just so many things like this I've found that all come together, and were all written so long ago, and yet they're coming to a head now, and I can see it. And many of us that are studying this can see it happening in the news every day. And we're waiting for the next big penny to drop, and that's going to be soon, I think, within 12 to 18 months, if not before.
Well, the name Lucifer, you could translate that the illumined one.
Yes, the light bearer, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And some of the organizations of the Illuminati even use the name of Lucifer in some of the names of organizations that they're behind. And they don't say, you know, this is Lucifer's organization, but they, if you look at the name, you'll see that it is sort of, the name is there, but they've sort of changed some of the ending or something, you know, but it's there.
Well, like the Lucis Trust that published the Urantia book about the true history of the world and where it's going. I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. That document, that book, is huge, and if you read it, it's written like it's in Old English to mimic the Bible that was translated in King James Version so that people would accept it. But it bends the truth a lot. And the Lucis, L-U-C-I-S, Trust was behind publishing it, as you said. Lucifer is part of that name, Lucis Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And the Illuminati are the enlightened ones, you know, they mm-hmm. follow the light bearer.
One of the things that... is really hard. I mean, I try to have discussions about this, even with my family, Stan. And it's so, so difficult because they've got so much tonnage of religious baggage attached to every term you try to use that they don't understand, for instance... there are some that I talk to that the Lucifer is a mythological spiritual being that's in the Bible and it's all religious. You know something? Now, there's a similar sort of attitude about Enki and Enlil and Marduk and those guys. But the fact is that there's absolutely no evidence to support that it's mythological. And there is evidence to support that these are real beings, that real humans, people of our species, saw face to face. And, you know, there are people on death row, and some have already been executed, on the strength of eyewitness testimony.
Hmm.
Okay, so there are people who are eyewitnesses to crimes who testify in court, and on the strength of that, someone gets sentenced to life in prison or gets sentenced to the death penalty on the strength of a couple of eyewitnesses. And then we find that's okay, that's good testimony for court, but then whenever it comes to this kind of stuff, people say, well, eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable. Hmm. And I run into that all the time. But talking about Lucifer, I don't know what his real name is that he was given at the moment he was created. Maybe it is Lucifer. I doubt it because that's Roman. But... whatever his real name is, there's a lot of evidence that this being, whoever he is an actual entity, an actual being that exists. And the problem, though, Stan, is people have attached to him so much fiction, you know, that the fiction is bigger than the guy.
Yeah. You know, he will be defeated. The Bible tells us that. And he will fall on the hot stones of Eden, and people will wonder after him and say, how is it that small creature that's there now dead on the stones of Eden, the hot stones of Eden, was such a powerful and terrible enemy to, you know, God, and God's Son, and to those who are, you know, Christian or Jewish believers in this Son of God. How is it that this small creature had that much power and we were so badly done by him? Now, that's another subject, but the hot stones of Eden, I retranslated part of that in Genesis, and a lot of it, in fact, and did locate where the Garden of Eden was and is today, but you can't see the growth and the flora and fauna there because it was located at the Danakil Plains of Ethiopia, northeast Ethiopia, and underneath where the water flowed down from the Great East African Rift, from the huge amount of dew and rainfall that fell down in that valley, and it provided water for the garden, for the trees and the animals that lived in the garden. And the garden was, in Hebrew, the garden means hedged about, so that you're kind of trapped in that area. It's like a natural cave of mountains. And the surrounding mountains and ridges were there in the Danakil Plains. Now, when man, or Adam and Eve, were kicked out of the garden, so they could never come back, the tale goes, in the English translation, which were not entirely correct, that God put an angel there to guard it so that they couldn't come back in, this flaming sword. That word that they used for that flaming sword was also used for a spinning, sparkling fire that comes out of a burning mountain, a volcanic thing. And if you look at it, I'm not going to tell you the whole book because it'd be too long here, but in the Vindicator Scrolls, I put all this evidence down with maps and bathymetry, under the ocean floor information there in Ethiopia to show where the great river had come out of the East African Rift, fallen down, and chewed a hole in the sea floor there while the Garden of Eden was intact. The volcano that sealed the entrance was one of 13 that we've been able to find that have covered that whole area in magma and basalt and stuff, and pure salt, over the generations and millennia that have passed since that time. And you'll see that it's a very inhospitable place and very hot. The stones are very hot. And the Garden of Eden is where Satan started the whole rebellion and had man do something that would cut him off from direct communication with the mind of the Creator. So that's a fitting place when he is finally judged, Lucifer, to put his body, when he is thrown down there into the hot stones of Eden. This is where you started it, and this is where I'm finishing it, says God. So there's so many little clues in there that you just... it's like trying to eat words when you start to translate. You get so hungry for it, mm-hmm. to find the truth that has been hidden all these years.
We have to step away for break. I do find it quite interesting that you talk about this is where his body will be, because he has a body. Whoever he is, whatever his original name is, he's a real being. It's not mythological. At least I don't think so. I think a lot of these old ancient gods that people wrote about are real. They were real beings that people stood and looked them in the face and saw them and talked to them. And one of them is a troublemaker. All right, we'll be back right after this.
And you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening, Stan Deo. Stan, let me ask you a question here about something that's really making waves out on the internet right now. And I mentioned it to you earlier. There is a blog out there that's saying that there's a worldwide sweep against the New World Order, and they're all going to be swept away, and massive arrests worldwide are going to be made against these New World Order Illuminati, and we're all finally going to be free, and it's claiming that it's already begun. Now, what I have written about that is I wish that were true. I really do. But there's no evidence of it. Now, one of the things that is cited as evidence is, well, what about all of these arrests of these journalists over in the UK, with the Murdoch newspaper over there? Okay, yeah, that happened, and there's no evidence that that has anything at all to do with a worldwide sweep against the New World Order. I don't see any evidence that that's going to happen. And principally, I don't see any evidence because the so-called Illuminati, the so-called New World Order bosses, are in charge of all of the police agencies that would have to do it. They're behind the scenes. They're behind the governments. I don't see any evidence that that is a fact. It's a nice thought. It's optimistic, but I think it's fiction. What do you think about that?
Let me ask you this to start with.
Mm-hmm.
If a group had the power on Earth to get rid of the Illuminati, to take them away from, you know, take them out of power and to lock them up or dispose of them, would you applaud that move? The Illuminati are defeated? You said you'd like to see it.
I think at this point, yes, I would like to see them lose their grip on power. Yeah.
Well, this is something that I, in my opinion, is going to happen.
My opinion too, but I don't think it's happening now.
No. And the Illuminists, remember, are working for Lucifer, Satan. They're under his control, whether they know it or not. I think the high levels do know it because they have to swear oaths and do all kinds of rituals to pledge their allegiance to him. I think a lot of them have actually met him. But because they are minions, as far as Lucifer is concerned, they're disposable. They're expendable. Mm-hmm. To obtain his objective is to beat the Son of God and to take over to keep the throne of Earth for himself. So if you are Satan, if you're Lucifer, and you're wanting to get the people on your side, and you know that the people are aware of the Illuminati, then you've got to give them a champion that gets rid of the Illuminati. And since they're your minions anyway, you don't care. You can give them over to whatever source you put in charge of the planet, and people will say, oh, look, you've gotten rid of the bad guys. And they don't realize that's the left hand, or the right hand as you're looking in the camera, to the other hand of the body. So one is helping you, and the others beating you on the head with a stick. Now, the Illuminati are going to be sacrificed, I'm pretty sure, are what appear to be the Illuminati in toto. The King of Bavaria tried this in the 1700s when he started killing off and imprisoning the Illuminati at that time. Adam Weishaupt was in that movement, and that's a matter of history. But to do a thing like that now, as you pointed out wisely, there's no group on Earth that could get around all the fingers, the hidden spies, and whatever the Illuminati have in the world, whether it be journalists, whether it be bankers, or whether it be your next-door neighbor. But it would be a very, very clever chess move for anyone taking over the planet to defeat the bad guys. And that might include not only the alleged Illuminati and the rich families, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and all this, that are, you know, listed in the books and treatises on this. I've got them in my Cosmic Conspiracy. Defeating not only them and the humankind, but also the little nasty greys that cut people up and dissect cows and, you know, are bad and hurt people. So if those are defeated, as well as the humans we know about or think we know about, then people are going to be very responsive to a new, peaceful, all-powerful government of the planet. And I think this is what we've got to watch. When rumors start coming out that the Illuminati are being disposed of, taken out of power, and people start to cheer, yay, 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 don't go where everyone else is going. I used to have a saying about this when I was in Dallas in the computer business. When my secretary would tell me, hey, I got a hot tip on the stock market, this share is going to really go, if I owned any of that share, I would sell it immediately, because by the time the masses know about it, it's where the controllers of that particular plan want you to go. They're heading you toward a particular gateway, and it's not changed. you know, talking about the journalist being illuminist. A journalist to me isn't even high enough in the food chain to be an illuminist. They can be a puppet. And if that's really happening, I don't know. I mean, but I think you and I both agree that this is not the defeat of the Illuminati as is being touted on these websites.
Okay, but you have a good point, and that is that such a scenario very well could happen. Well, I said I didn't think it could. It could happen if at the very top it was decided, okay, we're going to sacrifice some of these big-name people. They're still puppets, but they're big names. We're going to sacrifice some of these. We're going to round them up. We're going to defeat them. We're going to get rid of these grays. And but that's being done, according to the scenario you've outlined, that's being done to get everyone to willingly then say, oh, well, then these guys that got rid of all this evil stuff, that's good. Let's give our allegiance to them. And, you know, I said earlier, I just really don't like to say anything that comes from the Bible because people get religious about it. But that's one of the predictions. One of the predictions in Revelation is that all nations give their power to the beast. They're not conquered. They give it. So this New World Order, One World Government, will come about not as a result of war, but as a result of popular demand.
Yes.
If that happens to be an accurate prediction, then that's how that goes. You know, I don't get the same vitriol in email if I happen to quote something from Enki. But if I throw something in that came out of one of the books of the Bible, boy, I get it from all over the place. But, you know, speaking about Enki, there is a book called The Lost Book of Enki. And it purports to be an autobiographical account from Enki himself. And he talks about the first of his species to get to Earth. And I think it's pronounced Ailulul. And he was a deposed king on Nibiru. And he escapes to Earth. He gets to Earth. And it so happens that he finds gold on Earth, which they had already determined they needed to grind gold and put it into their upper atmosphere because of the orbit they were in and the depleting atmosphere that they had. It was getting way too hot when they got close to the sun and getting way too cold when they got far away from the sun. And so their scientists decided they needed ground gold, gold dust, in the upper atmosphere of Nibiru. He finds it, and he uses the beam to communicate. So we'll say he radioed back to Nibiru, and he said, hey, I'm here on this planet, and I found gold. So you make me king there again, and I'll tell you how to get here and where the gold is. And the council decided, according to the Lost Book of Enki, the council decided, tell you what, here's the deal. We will make you king of that planet. We'll recognize you as king of that planet. And you tell us how to find this gold. And the deal was done. Now here's my question. Let's assume that this Lost Book of Enki is accurate. Let's assume that Ailulul, if that's how you say his name, really did get here and this whole exchange really did happen. Well, what happens is when the rest of the Anunnaki get over here and start mining the gold, they decide they're really kind of above having to dig in the dirt. And so they decide to do genetic engineering on some beings that were already here. Now, whether people believe this or not, I mean, that's a different issue. This is the story. Okay? So they did, yeah. And the end result is us. That's the story. So suddenly, they decide they're in charge of all of this mining, and they're in charge of this new species, and Alulul kind of gets shoved to the side. They made a deal with him that he was going to be king here. And it turns out, didn't work out that way. What if Alulul is the same as the being referred to in the Bible as Lucifer? Because he is referred to in the Bible as the king of this world.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, I think certain parts of it agree with what we've seen in the translations of the book of Genesis. And what comes to mind as you're telling me this is, if it's 95% true, but 5% lie, for whatever reason, that book of Enki, then the whole thing is not trustworthy. You have to be careful of these things. And I think it could be Satan, Lucifer, has participated in the authorship of the Book of Enki to lay down a groundwork for what happened to support his case, saying, I mean, the Illuminists say that Lucifer was wrongly done by, you know, by the creators of the planet and of man, and therefore that he has the right to the throne, just like you're saying. So I see truth in a number of these ancient books that aren't part of canon, official canon of the Bible, and I take the information in and try to compare Enki with Enoch, with the Lost Book of Thomas or this or that, and try to sift through and get what is truth and agrees with the rest of the Bible and doesn't contradict it. It's hard to do sometimes, but I think we should study these other texts and manuscripts in the past, but with caution, with what mankind is able to bring to the table now and analytical tools. It makes it easier for us to see what documents that purport to be from a certain time period could not be because of the carbon dating or because of words used or phrases and the type of papyrus or goat skin or clay tablet that's written on, so that we can prove or disprove certain books.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We will come back right after this, so don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest Stan Dale. We're on Final Approach. We only have a few minutes left. And Stan, I had told you that we would take calls in the second hour, but we've been into some heavy stuff here, and we're only scratching the surface. There's so much of it. And so I haven't opened the telephone lines. Let me ask you this. Would you be willing to come back sometime in the near future and let's go a little deeper and take some calls as well?
Sure, sure. There are a couple points, if you give me time here, just before we finish today. On the Illuminati, some little-known things about the Great Seal of the United States. I know a lot of people have come to the party after I published The Cosmic Conspiracy, analyzing the duality and the hidden symbols in the Great Seal of the United States. It's on the $1 bill. But they have all failed to translate the Latin on the back of the Great Seal, where that pyramid and the eye floating over it is found. They've looked at it at Annuit Quepus Novus Order Seculum as meaning announcing the birth or arrival of a new order. But the problem is that there's one word in there that doesn't exist in Latin. It's seclorum. It's S-E-C-L-O-R-U-M. And they try to say that it's an abridged form of seclorum, meaning, you know, sacred order. It's not. It's two words into one, sec and lorem. And when you translate that on the Great Seal, it means announcing, annuit, queptus, the birth, novus ordo, new order, sec lorem, that favors the whip or the lash. This is not a nice order. And sec and lorem are real Latin words, and that's how they put it together. Even the Freemasons have a coin in some of the orders that you, it's on a little axis, and you can spin the coin. If you spin it fast, parts of one side appear with parts of the other side as one image, and it spells a message when you spin the coin, the duality. And that sec and lorem is part of that duality. It appears to be sacred, but it's not. It's favoring the whip or the lash like Satan. How much time we got left on this show?
Oh, let's see. We've got about 7.5 minutes here.
Aha.
Let me ask you a question that I want to get in based on something that you have talked about here tonight. Do you think there is going to be a false flag alien event?
Yes. Yes. And I think it will come very soon based upon the imminent nuclear war scenario forming in the Middle East between Israel, Iran, and Syria and Lebanon. And the Hezbollah and all the people that are part of the terrorist organization over there. The people of Earth are being brought to their knees in fear over that nuclear war, and it's going to intensify between now and the time of the election. Remember, Obama told Benjamin Netanyahu, hold back on your attack of Iran and stuff until after the election, until after I get in, making November, you know, the elections for November the deadline, so that war could be made to happen or appear to be about to happen in the Middle East before that time. There are a number of reasons for that, but we need that false flag at the time that the weather is very bad, you know, the climate, and we're seeing that with these super tornadoes that are throwing 16,000 pound truck trailers in the air like dominoes and little
30,000 pounds.
Oh, was it 30?
Yeah.
Right. My mistake, but I mean, you know, that's pretty impressive. And if we start seeing increases in hailstones up to 30, 40, 50 pounds, terrible things like that, magnetic field failing, which it's doing, solar radiation getting in and burning people's skin because the atmosphere is thinning, the ionosphere that protects us because the magnetic field is weakening, all these things are happening now and are going to intensify rapidly. And I think at the point that these major curves are so threatening, failure of the world economy and that kind of stuff, at that moment, people are going to be most receptive to the alien false flag. And they will look there for a solution because it's not part of us, as I've discussed earlier in the show. That's what I'm anticipating is going to be the next major move on the world prophetic clock.
You have set and talked with these Illuminati face to face.
Yes.
Did you have a sense that you were talking to people who were evil, or did you have a sense that you were talking to people who truly believed what they were up to was good?
The ones I talked with truly believed what they were doing was what someone needed to do to help mankind, and it fell upon their shoulders by, you know, luck of the draw or luck of birth. But they did have their human side, like Sir John not liking Jews. You know, that does color his neutrality a bit. And that had helped me personally. But yeah, with that exception, these are the cotton top, you know, white haired gentlemen, quiet spoken, and they lift a finger, a dozen people jump to do their bidding, but yet they're sitting there in comfort, you know, in their clubs, planning what they're doing to bring the world into this one world order.
And does it seem to bother them that some of what they're doing causes massive death across the planet?
At the upper levels, I didn't meet all of them, not just the ones that were down there in Melbourne at the round table, but I don't think I saw that in them. But I did see it in some of the lower ranking servants or participants under the Illuminati. that they were very sad about a lot of people dying because of what they were doing or would be doing. So the lower levels did have a conscience left, but the upper levels just seemed to trample on it and say it has to be done. I mean, it's like, well, we've got a plague of locusts, let's squash them or kill them, or too many kangaroos, let's cull them. You know, that's the way it is. And I think that's kind of the view that the top takes.
You know, powerful people are only as powerful as the rest of us let them be. And it is true that at any point where a large majority of the Earth's population decides, that's it, we're not putting up with this anymore, it could all just end like that. But it won't.
Yeah.
It won't, because we don't think that way. We think in terms of people being lofty, people being important. People, you know, they deserve our respect. Nobody deserves respect. You earn it. And because of the fact that powerful people are only as powerful as the rest of us let them be, I'm going to make a statement that you may disagree with, and I'll give you about 30 seconds to do that, and we'll be out of time. And that
All
is,
right.
The Earth's getting what it deserves. People are getting exactly what they deserve because they're so dumb.
Okay, you want my response?
30 seconds.
Okay. My response is, I wouldn't trust myself overthrowing them and then taking the reins of running the Earth or even a country. I know that I would be corrupted eventually from my human side, from my own frailties. I would make mistakes that I'd try to cover or explain and then end up being a dictator, just like the people trying to overthrow. We need to rewrite the human heart and get rid of that side of us that, you know, wants to have the control, the ego, and all of us have it. And we could all be just as bad as the people we're talking about.
Yeah, it really wouldn't do for me to be God. I'd be stepping on certain people right now. I mean, I'm telling you, I would. There's certain people, if I was God, they're finished.
I look at it like that, too.
Yeah. Okay, I want to thank you for being with us. If you will stay on the line with me for a moment, I'd like to chat with you for just a moment after I bring this in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this evening. Stan Deo, and he said he'll come back and talk with us some more in depth and allow you to give him a telephone call. He would have allowed that tonight, but I didn't, because we were so into it, and I wanted to hear what he had to say. We're going to bring him back, and we'll open the phone lines when we do that. All right, my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you'd like. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.